home of Cambridge music. We are Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, your fortnightly food and drink programme for Cambridge, with Matt Bentman and Ruth Reyes. Many thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the last 2 hours of music.
On today's programme, we have Austrian schnitzels from the latest street food van to hit Cambridge, and more wines of the month from Noel Young Wines in Drumpington.
Olive oil is the order of the day, and we feature two naturally organic producers presenting two naturally organic olive oil products. Whilst over in Market Square, there's a fresh new stall selling churros. This is when you wish you had Smell-O-Vision.
Books for Cooks in Notting Hill discuss some of their latest cookbooks to hit the shelves. And we venture out into Haslingfield and the beehives of Hawthorne Farm.
All this and more. So we'll have the city's food and drink news at the end of the programme. Let's kick off, Ruth.
Our first stop in the Cambridge food scene's tour of Europe takes us to Austria. We are soon to welcome Holy Schnitzels, Cambridge's newest street food, to, well, the streets. After much stir on Twitter and a name too intriguing to pass up, I got in touch to learn more about their schnitzels. So I'm here with Holy Schnitzels, who are the newest street food van to hit Cambridge, and they do schnitzels. So tell us a bit more about the schnitzels.
Well, the schnitzels came about really for, I guess, our passion for going over to Austria. Through eating a lot of Austrian cuisine, we thought, well, why isn't anybody doing this over here in the UK? Now, there are a few more established restaurants now out there, but there was nobody in street food that was doing something like this. And we thought, this is a perfect opportunity to offer another hot-filled alternative, or hot-filled sandwich alternative to burgers and some of the other things. And we thought, well, let's take the authentic recipes, which my family have handed down to us over the years, and see if we can adapt those to the street food environment, adding a few extra dressings and toppings and using things in traditional ingredients like the Kaiser roll, which we've worked with a local artisan baker to recreate over in here, using local flours. To also the importance behind sourcing all the products, the meats, those are all sourced locally.
We've sort of done lots of research and testing and trying out, and we just want to get it out there and hope people enjoy it as much as we do in our family.
Do you have an Austrian background?
Yeah, my family, my mother's side of the family, all come from Austria. She grew up in Upper Austria, and I spent a lot of summer holidays there and Christmases in Upper Austria. And then latterly, as we've come together as a family, we love our skiing. And it's just through that visiting and taking in that culture and all the various food and the atmosphere that has made it so much fun going back. And we return back as a family on quite a few occasions. The mountain air always keeps us sort of wanting to go back for more, I think. And the cuisine is you know, lovely. It's so sort of clean. It's not just all about, you know, potato salad and sauerkraut. There's a lot more to Austrian culture. There's a lot more influence that's been pulled in from other European countries surrounding them. If we go back to the definition of a schnitzel, it's basically any boneless cut of meat that is then, the French word for it is panade, but basically breaded, seasoned flour and egg and breadcrumbs. Austria didn't originally invent the schnitzel. In fact, it was the Italians that first came out with it in from Milan, and the Austrians then borrowed that recipe because the Kaiser wanted to put on some sort of special dinner function for various heads of state from other countries. And it was from that, really, it was then called the Wiener Schnitzel. They obviously use veal, so a true traditional Wiener Schnitzel will always be used. You always have veal. But latterly, more and more people now are using pork, and that's where we're adopting a Wiener Saar Schnitzel in our menu. Our stable or mainstay in terms of schnitzels. And then to that, we're also doing a chicken fillet schnitzel. We'll be doing also a pork fillet schnitzel with a breadcrumb that has parmesan in it. And I think the other key thing is that obviously we've obviously adapted made up some nice dressings which will accompany these schnitzels. With the pork one, we do a sour cream and roasted paprika dressing. The chicken one has a bayonnaise dressing, which again is like smoked pancetta with mayonnaise and some chilies thrown in, which gives it a bit of a kick. And then we'll be using obviously other sour cream. Also, yeah, we'll also be adopting a vegetarian option, partly because one of our daughters is a strong vegetarian, and it would be unfair to put on
a family business and not have a vegetarian option for her. So we're very much focused on it being a family business, and everything is just really simple, and our children create these schnitzels in their own homes as well. I've taught them how to do it. So it really is, this is like the third generation of original recipes. So yeah, we're really proud of what we do and what we've got to offer, and we just want to share it with a wider audience, really. We've worked really hard at keeping our ingredients local. Our chickens were rescued battery hens, and they literally have a whole orchard to run in, and they're absolutely gorgeous, and that's just in the next village. And we're using two farms for our meat. One is Fable Farm in Kwai, and the other farm is Cuckoo Hill Farm, which is a new farm shop that's just opened near Westwick. So there are only two suppliers of meat. So yeah, everything is as local as we can possibly get it.
And we've spent a lot of time actually visiting the farmers to really understand, you know, what their ethos is in terms of their breeding, just to get a better idea of who we're dealing with, really, when looking at the food chain. So, yeah, we're confident and really happy with what we've come up with. Let's hope our consumers feel the same way. I think one of the other things, whenever you go to Austria and you're up in the mountains, you're walking, if you go to a particular mountain hut, to have a drink, it'll typically be either a warm drink that you'll consume on a very cold day, but obviously in the summertime or autumn, they sell a lot of this drink called Almdudler. And what it is a blend of apple and grape juice that is carbonated. And it's just a very, very refreshing drink to have. So we've been lucky enough to find a supplier for that over here in the UK. And on top of that, we also found a brand new drink that came out at the end of last year called Omi's Apple Strudel Drink. And it's a fantastic product. It's a natural product made from apples from the South Tyrol. And added to that is obviously cinnamon. And it is essentially a dessert in a bottle. It's apple strudel in a bottle, which you must try if you get the opportunity. We're really lucky and excited about that. That's quite a coup for us. We're probably the only people, probably East Anglia, or outside of London, that are selling that. So,
how did you decide to do this?
We went over and had a meal with our son. He cooked schnitzels. And he said, wouldn't it be great to do a street food van and call it Holy Schnitzels? Well, after much hysteria and laughing, we thought, actually, that's not such a bad idea. It's not crazy. Let's just do it. And this was about 2 years ago now. Subsequently, my husband got made redundant. And we thought, well, actually, if we don't do something together, which we've always wanted to do, then we're not going to get the opportunity. So we thought, right, let's do it. So we searched, came and got a VW LT van, which we've converted from a Help the Aged van, and we're ready to go now.
Yeah, very excited. I think it gives us the option to try and get as many people on board interested in schnitzels. Yeah, we looked forward to serving many schnitzels to Cambridge people.
I look forward to eating many schnitzels. where will we see you next then?
We've got a big festival booked in Thetford at the end of July, so that's our first big launch, really.
And the other things that we've got penciled in, obviously, Mill Road Festival, that's coming up early August, and also Mitcham's Corner as well. But the other things that, yeah, we will be popping up all around Cambridge, UK. We will choose our sites according to sort of demographic and also the people that we can mix bolt on to. So if there is a pub out there that doesn't currently do food on a particular night, you know, we can join forces and still offer them a food option. But there'll be many other opportunities as well to catch us, whether it be outside and off licence or various farms. So we're welcome to, you know, we're really looking forward to working with lots of partners out there to try and grow this food street food business. And I guess also for private functions, whether it be for weddings, if there are any wedding planners out there that see an opportunity for street food to be part of their option, then again, we'd love to sort of speak to them again, because I think that's something that we can do really well and add a lot of atmosphere to. So there are loads of opportunities out there, and I think we've got a Twitter handle. We've got a Facebook page and soon to launch a website as well. So all those platforms, people will be able to follow us and find out where we're going to attend. So there will be some pop-ups very soon for them to attend and try our shit sauce.
They will. I'm very excited to see you out on the streets. Thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you.
Great.
I wasn't kidding when I said I'm looking forward to eating many more schnitzels. I could eat them for days. They have some excellent ideas for the months to come, including offering a different traditional salad every day to accompany your schnitzel, paprika chips, and a brilliant name, and most importantly, an excellent product. It's home comfort food taken to the next level and on the go. Keep an eye out for their van, and you can find them on Twitter at Holy Schnitzels.
Now, Cambridge foodie Pina Broccoli Anaya regularly attends and reports on the latest food and drink happenings in the city. She says with a surname like Broccoli, which was meant to write about food. She does this via Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, as well as her blog 12culinarystew.com. Today, she's presented a report for us on an infused olive oil tasting hosted by Olio Italia and Agrumia.
I'm coming to you from Limoncello on Mill Road, where an olive oil tasting is taking place with Mauro Borrero of Olio Italia and Francesco Amato of Agrumia. Mauro Borrero of Gurton-based Olio Italia is bringing a new range of organic-infused extra virgin olive oils to Cambridge. Hi, Mauro. Thank you for speaking with us.
That's an absolute pleasure, Pina.
The infused olive oils are produced and bottled by Pata with the extra virgin olive oil from their olive grove in Calabria, Italy.
That's absolutely right.
They're named Le Opere e I Giorni, which is translated as...
The works and the days, allegedly from a very ancient Greek poem. The ancient Greeks colonized Calabria and they were very impressed with the quality of the produce down there. And the tradition is living on to this day.
So can you tell us about the six flavors that we have here today at Limoncello for the olive oil tasting?
We have two citrus infusions. One, it's bergamot. Bergamot is indigenous of Calabria. And then we have lemon. These two infusions go particularly well with white meats and fish. And you can also use them to roast vegetables and on salads. Then we have a basil infusion and a combination of garlic, black pepper and balsamic vinegar. Then we also have some rosemary. And finally, last but not least, we have some chili. All the oils are produced through the agrumato process. That means that the herbs or the fruits are pressed together with the olives, and this guarantees products of outstanding quality and absolute utmost purity.
I've tried them all, and I can certainly vouch for the fresh, vibrant taste of these infused oils. I particularly like the rosemary, drizzling it on some potatoes or chicken and roast them in the oven. And there's so many uses you can do for all of these flavors, so it's fantastic, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. They are extremely versatile. You can just put a spoonful of them on a bowl of pasta and rice, and that's a meal in itself. Or you can be more adventurous and use them on red meats, on fish, on vegetables. The usages that you can get out of these oils are boundless.
So you can get more information on Le Opere e Giorni Organic Infused Extra Virgin Olive Oils on Olio Italia's website at olioitalia.eu. You can find the infused oils in some shops, including Limoncello here on Mill Road, as well as online. Thanks for your time, Mauro.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We also have with us Francesco Amato, the founder of Agrumia, an online distributor specializing in Italian products. They are a Cambridge-based company who supply their products nationally and all over Europe. They carry a staggering variety of Italian delights, including Le Opere e Giorni infused olive oils. Hi, Francesco.
Hi.
I believe at the moment you are the exclusive online reseller of the organic infused extra virgin olive oils.
Yes, I am. I'm the only one.
Excellent. Well, how has the demand been so far?
Well, if we think that we've been operational for just a month, I have to say that the demand for this particular product has been very, very high.
Are you keeping track of any particular flavors that are more popular than others, or it's a combination of...
Yes, there are a couple of flavors that are bestsellers, like the combination of garlic, black pepper and balsamic, for instance. The basil, which is a new product we just introduced and selling very well. although my favorite is the chili one, I have to say.
I'm torn between the chili, the garlic one, and the basil one is new, and I think that makes a really nice, like, automatic pesto just drizzled on your pasta. Super
Absolutely.
Easy. And like I mentioned before, you know, it has such a fresh vibe and flavor. All the ingredients, the infused ingredients, are organic as well. I'm really a fan of this product, so I'm really happy to be speaking with you. You can find Agrumia at agrumia.co.uk, where you're free to browse through their range of fantastic Italian products. Thanks for talking to us today, Francesco.
Thank you for having me here.
Limoncello is at 212 Mill Road. More information on their website at limoncello.co.uk. And you can find Le Opere e Giorni infused organic extra virgin olive oils at their shop. And you're listening to Flavor on Cambridge 105.
Certainly are. And that was Pina Broccolianaia reporting on Le Opere e Giorni, the new organic-infused extra virgin olive oils being introduced to the UK market from two Cambridge-based suppliers of long standing. You can read about these olive oils in more detail on Pina's blog, once again, 12culinarystew.com.
At Cambridge 105, we're proud to be out and about in our city. If you've got a local event coming up and you'd like us to be part of it, drop your details over to publicity@cambridge105.fm. Cambridge 105, the station that cares the most about the community.
Last weekend, Matt went to a farm that produces and sells its own honey. He wanted to see what goes on in a hive and discovered that not only are there queens and drones, but also guard bees, sizable squadrons who keep an eye out for hapless reporters. And so the following was recorded with the aid of a full beekeeper's uniform and thick, heavy gloves, so we apologise for any poor audio.
Bees have been getting increased exposure in the media recently. Lots of sudden realisation stories about our food chain being dependent upon them for pollinating millions of acres of agricultural crops. And then there's global warming, the impact of predatory species and diseases, European hornet invasions swiftly wiping out our polite, reserved, suit-and-tie-wearing British bumblebee. There's interesting news too. More and more people taking up beekeeping in urban areas, producing unusual honeys, as the bees source their pollen from people's garden plants and windowsill plant pots. And I'm here today on the outskirts of Cambridge, and I'm with Sarah Chandler and her partner Ian. So these beehives are called apiaries, is that right? It's a great term?
Apiaries.
An aviary.
Yeah, it's the whole place, if you know what I mean, is the apiary.
It's
a place to keep bees.
Yes, yeah.
Right, next, A-B.
It's a buzzing thing, isn't it?
How long have you been doing this now?
We've been doing it about 8 years. Found a swarm of bees on a walk once and kind of thought, hang on a minute, we should be doing this, you know.
We did a course at the Cambridge Beekeepers. They run every year.
All right, yes.
Plus, if you become a member, you can borrow equipment, so you don't have to buy an expensive extractor. You can just go and borrow them,
which is
nice. I've got 32 hives here in total, 10 big colonies, working hives, and the rest are all nukes, which are swarms I've collected. Mm. And when they fill out the frames, I'll transport them into a proper hive. So they don't like too much space, so you have to keep them small at first, you know, so they can build out.
Swarms that you've collected sounds very interesting. It makes you sound like you're a hunter going off into the fields and you can identify where these places are. Is that roughly it?
What happens is I get a phone call because I'm on the website, the Bees Association, so people will have them in their garden, phone me up and I'll go and bring them back here.
But I have seen her follow them down the road in my car.
I have followed her, yes.
And it's gone over the top. Sometimes they don't stop.
They don't stop and
then
take off.
Can I have your keys? And off she went.
I did. I followed them.
I
followed them down and they landed in a tree and I caught them and brought them back.
Wow.
Not escaping.
So you said these were some of these smaller hives.
Yeah, swarms that I've collected out of the tree. Got about 20,000 bees in. So what I've done is I've smoked them, and I've taken the roof off, and then we'll come down to a crown board, and then under the crown board is...
the honeycombs.
Yeah, this is where the bees make their honey.
Now, as you explained to me earlier, smoking prompts them to...
prompts them to go and feed from the honey, so it fills their abdomen up to stop them stinging you. It doesn't actually make them sleepy. And as you can see, the hive, they like to stick everything up, so you need to get your hive tool under and then unstick it. You take the super off, which is where the honey's stored. Then we come to a queen guard to stop the queen coming up into your honey. You don't want her laying eggs in your honey.
Queen guard.
Yeah.
Blimey, look at this. So you can identify just by looking externally here where the queen roughly is.
Yeah, she generally is where the eggs are laying.
So you can see them all feeding on the honey now. Now I'm smoking them.
Yes, yes.
They think there's a forest fire or something. They're all getting ready to leave, so they're gorging on the honey.
I noticed there that one of the combs you pulled out looked very fresh. So this is a fresh set of
combs? This is a fresh hive, yeah. This is all the wax sheets here, and then they draw the wax out.
How long has it taken them to produce this?
These have been in here a week, so they're on 5 frames now. See, there's some little larvae in there.
Oh, yes, yes.
They're the babies.
Oh, and I can see some dark, dark-coloured
pollen. That's pollen, yeah. The sort of green stuff's the hawthorn.
Yes.
And it just varies on what they're feeding.
Ah, now, look at this.
No, she's not. Oh, no, she's there.
There you go.
She's bigger, but she's not as big as I thought she would be. But you homed in on her straight away.
She's got a longer body. That was probably luck more than anything. She's just got a longer abdomen, so she can reach down into the cells and lay her egg. That's why the workers can't do it.
Ah, right.
So it's only her.
Oh,
you bugger.
It's got you. Shall we move?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've set them off now.
And when you're checking them, what is it that you're checking for?
I'm checking to make sure the queen's still in there,
yeah.
So because we don't want to lose the queen and have no eggs, otherwise that's your hive gone. And I'm checking for diseases and pests, so
okay.
Like
varroa mites,
yeah.
Wax moth.
And wax moths.
Are things like varroa mites easy to spot as well?
Varroa mites are very tiny, they're almost like fleas, they're really small, but you can tell because some of the bees will have like chewed off wings.
I think I saw some photos where it looks like they almost piggyback off the back of the bumblebee. They look like a backpack.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we use varroa mite treatment over winter being
they
infested.
Sulfur dioxide, is it now?
Yes. But
which
we don't use that.
And they really don't like that.
No.
But people are using it now.
So that's a stronger, harsher chemical, is it?
I think so.
Yeah. More like acid, I think.
Yeah.
It's not very nice. We use icing sugar to control the varroa mite, which is a more natural way of doing it.
Oh.
So you sprinkle the icing sugar on the top of the hive when you've finished, and yeah, that will sort the varroa mite out.
Is there a reason why more beekeepers don't do that? Is it just because you need more of that to produce the same effect as the chemical?
I think it's people don't know, really. I think it is just something that, you know, people pick up, and it is becoming more popular to use ice and sugar rather than chemicals.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay, so here's the next one. Because every one of your beehives here are raised off the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. That's for ease of work, I think.
Yeah.
More than
my back.
Ah, now look at this.
I've been taking honey,
I think,
so there's not as much there.
Wow, these guys are automatically much more aggressive, I think.
Yeah, there's just more.
There's more in here, so yeah, and I've been taking the honey, so they're not that happy at the moment.
Ah. And perhaps, again, a very neophyte question, but how do you take their honey from them?
I lift the supers off and scrape all the bees off. Well, not scrape them off, but you brush them off.
Yeah.
Gently. And then I take it to a centrifuge and spin it. You are standing in there.
Just lifting off the...
Standing in their flight path.
Oh, am I?
Yeah.
Ah, that's why. Should I stand to the side?
Yeah.
See how they've stuck it all together
with
the propolis?
Stuck it down.
What was that word you used just then?
Propolis.
Propolis.
Yeah, which is their glue.
Ah.
Which is all this dark orange...
Yes, yes.
And that's sticky.
It's very sticky. Yeah, it's very sticky.
Very stuck.
Very stuck.
Oh, wow.
Sorry. And roll the bees. I don't particularly
Blimey,
like that.
Whoa, I'm being attacked everywhere. Okay, this is a test of your mettle. Blimey.
It's scary, isn't it?
It is scary, yeah. Whew. Now, this honeycomb is so much darker. It's more like a coffee colour.
Yeah, this is an older one, so it's been in there a year or two. So the longer it's in there, the darker it gets because they start building it up with propolis.
Yes.
You know, it makes it harder to work with as well when they start getting a bit, darker because you can't see the eggs.
Yeah, normally on a hot day, that's when you choose to come in.
Half of these will be out. That's why you don't want to come in.
Oh, I see. So actually, coming here on a cooler day, just after it's been raining, is worse for recording.
Yes.
This is quite intense.
Yeah.
Very. They hate this microphone. They hate my hand.
Right, it's only a sting.
But myself and Ian are all tightly suited up here. I feel like there's nowhere that the bees could get through, but you know from experience that the bees will find
there's a space.
Yeah, no, we've had one in the Vale.
Oh, in the Vale?
In that suit. Yeah. I didn't tell you before you went in. But last time I wore that suit, one got in.
Yeah?
Yeah. And then I'll walk up, find the little nook and cranny.
Yeah.
And it was just there at the front, and I managed to... before it got me, but...
I mean, something that starts with A, B.
Honey? Honey starts with A, B.
He's right, you know, Blackadder. Honey does start with a B. And a flower, too.
Now, honey is sometimes referred to as nature's benign golden sweetener. It never goes bad. It's baked into everything from cereals to biscuits, sauces and medicines, and it will crystallise over time. The more pollen in your honey, the quicker it crystallises. Oh, wow. Yeah, he went for it.
I got stung on the eye once. That was...
You got stung on the eye?
Right on the corner of the eye.
Oh.
Sarah had been in the hive around, and I was nowhere near, and it just went... Bash.
Yeah.
And it got me, and that made me swell up. I looked pretty good for about a week.
Were you just risking it? As in, were you going...
No,
he wasn't even in the bees.
It. She'd finished.
I was in the bees, and I'd come around a corner, and he was miles away.
And I didn't even see it coming. It's just the way it swelled up. It went down my face, and I looked good. I looked like I'd been in a fight. I did.
You had been in a fight.
Well, yeah, I lost as well.
The ivy extraction, that's the stuff that you leave for the bees in order to survive the winter.
Yeah. We like to give them a bit of honey back, not just give them loads of sugar. So
you can buy feed from other places, but we kind of want to keep it as pure and natural to them.
Mm.
We tend to just let them have their own feed, which is easier for us and nicer for them.
So with these 30 hives that you have here, Sarah, you produce the honey?
Yes, we produce the honey and we jar it up and we sell it out the front of our holding. We're in Hazlingfield, up Cantelope Road, and, yeah, we have two different types of honey at the moment. We have the creamed honey and we have the runny honey. Creamed honey, it creams because of the rape seed that we have around here. So it goes hard, and then we basically heat it up to 40 degrees, and then we get like a potato masher and you mash it, and once it's creamed, it's not hard, it's spreadable honey rather than being granulated.
And how long does it take for you to produce it? There must be a lot of work involved.
You have to extract it, so you put the frames into an extractor, and then, I mean, that take a good hour to just extract.
You mentioned a centrifuge earlier.
Yeah, that's the honey extractor.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you put the frames in, and you just spin a handle, and it spins off into a jug, and then you have to put it into a settling container after that to get all the bubbles out, and before you put it in there, you have to send it through some sieves to, you know, to get out the, you know, bits of wax and propolis and the odd bee that ends up in it. So you leave it in the storage containers, and then after about a week, you can then jar it up and then label it up and sell it.
So Sarah Chandler and Ian, very nice to meet you. It's nice to meet your bees as well.
Yes.
They were very happy to chat.
Sorry.
And we're here at Hazlingfield, in the farm in Hazlingfield.
Yes.
Just up Cantelope Road.
Hawthorne Farm, for all those people who want to come and purchase your honey.
Yeah. Yep.
Runny and creamy.
Yep.
Well, Sarah and Ian, thank you very much. And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hawthorne Farm in Hazlingfield. I did say that name too fast in the feature, I think, but I was a bit shell-shocked by the bees. The original recording was four times the length, okay, and it gets a bit scary when you honestly can't tell if those bees have finally managed to get underneath your veil. Anyway, as the label on the jar says, this is pure Cambridge honey, and they sell the creamed and runny honey in one-pound jars. That's about 450 grams.
If you're interested in keeping bees yourself, Sarah and Ian mentioned the Cambridgeshire Beekeepers Association, who runs a course for beginners consisting of 8 evening classes. That takes place at Chesterton Community College on Gilbert Road. The course is around £45, and you can find out all about it by visiting their website, cbka.org.uk.
And Hawthorne Farm, this is a family-run small holding, is also online at hawthornfarm.net. You can buy the honey direct from them, as well as other farm produce such as lamb, pork and free-range eggs.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Now, following my nose to the lovely smell of chorizo cooking, I happened along one of Cambridge Market's newest stalls, Churros para Todos. Clearly, I needed to know more. I'm here with Jamie from Churros para Todos, which you've been trading on the market not very long.
No, we've only been going about 8 or 9 weeks. We've started off with churros, and we've literally just branched out into doing a live paella as well.
How do you make the paella when you're here on the market?
Well, a lot of the prep is done at home. So the chicken is boxed up and the peppers are chopped, onions chopped, etc., etc. But it's all transported to the market and then cooked in an authentic Valencian paella pan, which we imported from Spain.
What's in the paella you have now?
We have, obviously, we import. All our ingredients are authentic. So we get Maratelli rice from Navarra, which is gluten-free. We also have genuine Spanish chorizo, which again is gluten-free. We put chicken, green beans, red peppers, decent chicken stock, saffron, mix of spices, couldn't tell you about. Just cook it in the pan, and that's generally it.
Brilliant. So what made you decide to do churros and paella?
We love Spanish food. We holiday in Spain regularly. We have Spanish friends as well, who I have to acknowledge have helped me with some of my recipes. Very kind of them. We're just passionate about Spanish food. It's one of our favourites. Our kids love it. And we thought, well, why not? We'll give it a go on the market.
So how have you been finding it on the market?
It's been great. Everyone's been very welcoming. Other traders have been very kind. And fortunately, things have been selling all right. A bit of a slow start until people get to know you. But once they know what days you're on and they obviously get to know your product and they like it, then, we get some good regular custom. So we're really enjoying it.
What days are you on the market?
We've got regular days on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. We also apply to the market management team just for the odd casual as well. So you can sometimes find us on a Sunday or a Saturday, definitely a Tuesday and a Wednesday. We're on Twitter and I tweet regularly about when you can find us and where you can find us as well.
So what's the Twitter handle?
I think if you searched for Churros para Todos, you'd find us, but it's at JamieRice701.
Do we see you outside the market at all?
We're hoping to be doing things outside the market. There's things in the offing and things that we're planning, but for the time being, we're kind of happy being on the market, growing as a very early, you know, little enterprise. But we hope to be able to be doing perhaps catering for some events, whether they be, you know, private birthdays, wherever that may be. But that's to be in the future.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Jamie. It's been lovely to meet you.
And you. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Obviously, I had some paella and some churros, and it tasted very authentic. It's very cool to see the big paella pan there too. You can catch them on the market on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and if you follow them on Twitter, at Jamie_Rice701, you can find out when they're there on any extra days, as well as the optimum time to get to that paella.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Now, before going off on holiday, Alan Alder paid another visit to Books for Cooks, that's the cookbook shop in Notting Hill, to delve into some of the latest titles on the market, ably accompanied by the shop's Mariana Torres.
The first one that I have here is Fernvara. It says here, recipes from a farm and its kitchen. So this is a biodynamic farm in Hertfordshire.
Oh, is it biodynamic?
Yeah.
Right.
And yes, it's really interesting. And it's got loads and loads of interesting recipes. I have to say, I have had a hard time picking some recipes from here. I think the whole book is just designed really well. The pictures are absolutely stunning. Like a lot of close-ups of their vegetables. I think you can see that the food is really good quality. So there's these buckwheat galettes filled with spinach bechamel. Yeah, and they always give you a little bit of an introduction to the flavours, and they say nutty taste.
So it's divided into sections, and this is
section. Yes, it's divided by produce.
So fried duck egg with asparagus, sage and parmesan.
Yes.
I think egg and asparagus is pretty common, but adding the sage is a nice idea, actually.
Yes.
It's also the spring. It's divided by season as well.
Which is very useful.
Yeah. Oh, now look at that.
Yes, this
edible
is a section,
flowers.
Yeah. Edible flowers.
Yeah. A lot of people still don't know about edible flowers. You know, people grow nasturtiums and don't eat the leaves, don't eat the flowers.
Yeah, I've been getting quite a lot of people asking for edible flower books here. I think more and more people are being aware of it.
Is there a gap in the market for a book solely about edible flowers, isn't it?
There are a couple of books already. Yeah, so it tells you all the different flowers from which plants you can eat.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are sort of reasonably well-known, things like chives, borage, lavender even, but I don't know that many people know about eating pansies or pot marigolds.
And it tells you exactly what to do with them and how,
well-known.
Yeah.
Sunflowers, it's only actually safe to eat the petals, so it is always worth looking things up. you know, before you eat them.
Yeah.
Plenty of flowers, you can eat the whole flower, but some, you're advised only to eat the petals. So this is the summer section that the flowers are in. That's nice. That's a nice idea. Right, so a big book, lots of ideas in it, including Josterberry Ripple ice cream. 400 grams of Josterberries. So I can't say I know what Josterberries are. And they say in the introduction they can't remember how many times they've been asked what they are.
Yeah.
And it's a cross between a gooseberry and a blackcurrant. Gosh. Yeah, and onto autumn, things like onion tatter.
Yeah, they talked a lot about the farm.
The biodynamic principles, really. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's very interesting.
Right, so that's a book for the grower, the person who wants to grow their own, as well as
the gardeners.
Yeah. Great, okay, so that's Fern Vero, and it's by Jane Scotter and Harry Astley.
Yes.
Brilliant, okay.
Okay, now, the second one here, very, very popular book at the moment. So this is Kai Gengel's new restaurant, Spring. It's a new cookbook that just came out. And it's absolutely gorgeous, just like all the previous ones.
Right, and this is the restaurant at Somerset House, isn't it, that she's opened, which is supposed to be meticulous. And I can see that the book is pretty meticulous as well.
I think the whole styling, not just of the food, but also the restaurant itself, and apparently also the uniforms of the waiters there. It's everything, a lot of attention to detail.
Yeah.
And you can definitely see that in the recipes. Yes, I mean, it's a lot of delicious, like, simple, minimal style salads.
Right, so that's a sort of feature of the book, is the simplicity, is it?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, as it's called Spring, I think the book really gives you that essence of, also, again, fresh produce and simplicity. Yeah, so there's a lot about the history of the restaurant. There's a lot of text about, you know, her thoughts on the concept of the restaurant and the design.
But plenty of recipes all the same.
Definitely.
Salad of beetroot, tomatoes, goat curd and radicchio. Yeah. This is a very, you know, it's a very smart-looking book. You wouldn't want to sort of spill things on it, really, would you?
Yeah.
Wild salmon with preserved lemon butter sounds good. Grouse with corn puree and roast figs. That's an interesting combination. And I see also there's, because we've just done a feature, there's a goat farm in Cambridge, to everybody's surprise. So here's the recipe, braised kid with squash, tamarind and chickpeas.
Mm.
And as she says here, goat is an underused meat with a wonderful, rich, almost earthy flavour. So this book's selling well, is it?
Definitely. It's one of the best sellers.
And do people know about it when they come in usually? Have they read reviews?
Yes, definitely. Or? We've had a lot of people looking for the book before it came out.
A nice section on vegetables. What was that? That's a very colourful one there. That does not look nice. Samphire and chilli oil. Mm. Yeah. Well, that's simple.
Yeah.
And beautiful.
Yes.
I would love to eat it.
Tasty. Very simple, but delicious. I mean, then fermented foods as well. Kombucha, sauerkraut, and kimchi. Yeah, it has everything.
Yes, it has. It's got a good range, hasn't it?
It goes from Asian to Middle Eastern to Italian.
And what's in the dessert section, I think?
A lot of fruits.
Iced summer fruits with rose-scented geranium syrup. It just looks beautiful. Yeah.
A lot of fruits. A lot of
quince and cob nut tarts. So some quite unusual.
Seasonal, like British.
That looks like a nice book. And just to remind us, it was Spring, the cookbook by Sky Gingell. Great, lovely. Honey and Co.
Honey and Co.
Food from the Middle East. This is by Sarit Packer and Itamar Srulovich. And this, of course, is based on the restaurant just in Warren Street, isn't it?
Yes.
A very popular restaurant. I've tried several times to book a table and never with any luck.
And the book also, again, absolutely one of the best sellers.
Is it?
And it actually won the award, the Fortnum & Mason Award. Yes, I think this book is absolutely amazing. It's especially for like salads and raw and fresh produce. Like the beginning of the book is all about, obviously, messe and different salads. Yeah, this book does that really well. I think this is a recipe that we've cooked here in the test kitchen.
And this is beetroot and plums in a rose and walnut dressing. And did that go down well?
Yes, definitely. Very well.
Your customers liked that one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, just picked this as well, Moroccan carrot pickle. Yeah, I mean, you can just see the spices involved and everything. It's just...
And yet that one is relatively simple, isn't it? Mm. The ingredients are, well, carrots, vinegar, sugar, salt, white mustard seeds, bay leaves, cloves and harissa paste. Mm. It's not going to be too taxing, is it?
No, definitely. And then it actually says it's It keeps for 2 weeks, so I mean it's.
So there's a section on.
See, the hummus is here.
Now, it'd be interesting to try that recipe because there are so many different recipes for hummus, aren't there?
Yeah, they use bicarbonate of soda, which is just going to make it very fluffy.
Ah.
So I think that's there. Yeah, but it's interesting because I would say half of the book is on starters and salads and mezze, which is, you know, unusual. Usually most of the book is on mains.
Yeah.
And then the other half is on main courses.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay, that's really nice. So that's Honey and Co's Food from the Middle East. Nice.
Okay, next one is...
A Bird in the Hand by Diana Henry. And you recommended one of her books previously,
I
think.
I had The Change of Appetites.
That turned out
to
be
a very
good. That
was really good. I think all her books just got done really well.
Actually, it is interesting. There's several of the books that you've recommended. You recommended before they were big sellers, and then they became big sellers. So I think you're very good at spotting them.
Well, they're good.
Anyway, so what's a Bird in the Hand? Chicken recipes.
Yes, for every day and every mood.
And it's a big book of chicken recipes, isn't it? There must be a lot of recipes
Angela
in there. And
Lawson says, I wish I had written this book. Okay, so this is another recipe that we've done here in the kitchen.
Rupa's lemongrass and turmeric chicken with potato salad and date and tamarind chutney. When you make them in the kitchen here, they have to be things that can be made fairly quickly,
yes,
I would have thought.
Yes, easily. I think this one was really interesting because it was like an Indian spiced dish, but that it wasn't a curry. And I think people really liked that. And it wasn't like the plain old curry with rice. It was like an interesting, exciting chicken recipe with a potato salad. It's quite different.
Yeah.
You don't see that very often.
Yeah.
I mean, literally every recipe is a chicken recipe. So if you like chicken, then
this is the book for you, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I see some of the recipes are for chicken pieces rather than whole chickens as well. So it's good for if you're just cooking for a small number.
Yeah, Indonesian roast spiced chicken with mango and tomato salad. Yeah, I mean, there's just so many different.
Yeah, and here's a recipe from the Dominican Republic, which has a huge number of ingredients, really.
I'm sure it's very tasty.
Right, okay, and so let's just remind ourselves of what that one is. That's Diana Henry, A Bird in the Hand. And not only does Nigella Lawson say on the front, I wish I'd written this book, Yota Lengi says on the back, everything Diana Henry cooks, I want to eat. Yeah. Getting some good reviews.
Yes.
Right, this one, A Lot on Her Plate by Rose Birkett. I don't know Rosie Birkett.
So she's she's a British food writer and food stylist. She was living in Vancouver for a while as well, and she talks a lot about that, travelling, how it influenced her cooking. Right. And it's just, I think it's a bit of a different book from all the other ones that we've talked about. I think it's much more dedicated for like younger people and a lot of entertaining your friends, I think. So she's a bit younger than the other books that we've talked
about. Kale and coriander pancakes with slow roasted tomatoes and avocado cream. Picture of it looks good.
Yeah. She put a little roast chicken. This is another one that they've made here that went really well. I think chicken goes really really well in this kitchen.
And this will be quite hot with the chilies, I guess.
Definitely.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there's an iceberg lettuce and coriander salad with lime too. Which sounds like quite a nice combination with something spicy.
So it's a warm salad of roasted aubergine and broccoli with anchovy lemon dressing.
Yeah.
I remember that was very good.
Right, any desserts in here?
Oh, definitely. That's cherry pie.
Yeah, well, this is the one that's on the cover, isn't it? Yeah.
It's definitely like orange and ginger madeleines.
Blueberry, basil, and almond pudding pie. Now, that looks an extraordinary colour. Mm.
Yes, I think she has a really good sense of what the young generation, you know, is into.
So, what's that one called again?
A Lot on Her Plate by Rosie Birkett.
So, this one is The Violet Bakery Cookbook by Claire Tack, P-T-A-K.
Yes. So this has been getting a lot of attention as well. She used to work for Chez Panisse. So
Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. So it should be very good then.
Yes, apparently it is really good.
One of America's top restaurants.
Here, so obviously it's only desserts. Apricot and almond polenta muffins. Yeah, I think she has a really good taste for a combination of ingredients.
Does she? Yeah. Right. And strawberries with ginger here. Now, that's quite unusual. Strawberry, ginger and poppy seed scones, or scones. Yeah. Strawberry and ginger. That's not a combination you see that often, is it?
And poppy seed.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't mind trying those.
They look a little bit of savoury as well. Tomato and marjoram tarts. And then mozzarella, rosemary and new potato tarts. Everything just sounds...
Yeah, well, it's a nice book.
Squash, brown butter and sage quiche.
Right, so this one's this one's selling, what is it, red plum Victoria sponge. What a nice idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the design is quite nice.
Honey and rose water madeleines, yeah.
I think it gives you a lot of content. You know, it's not just a pretty picture.
Content book, in terms of...
In terms of the recipes, it just tells you a lot of... A little bit of an introduction and then the... It's clearly not just a coffee table book, just for pictures. It has a lot of recipes. Yeah, there's a lot of traditional, you know, just scone recipes, but then there's like a new take on, like, classics.
Olive oil sweet wine cake. Chocolate sandwich cookies. Gosh, they look positively evil. That's
Rye chocolate brownies.
Yeah, well, they look great, don't they? They look tremendous. Good.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's this one? This one is The Violet Bakery Cookbook by Claire Ptak.
Thank you, Ellen and Mariana. Those six books reviewed today have all been released in the last few months and are available to order from Books for Cooks in Notting Hill, who can deliver anywhere in the world. So just phone, fax or email them your details and they'll do the rest. Their website is booksforcooks.com.
Noel Young Wines in Trumpington are back with their latest recommendations. Matt went along to their tasting rooms, revealed his ignorance by casually tossing aside a 450-pound bottle of wine that was resting on a chair, and promptly fell silent for the next sequence.
Hi, this is Daniel from Noel Young Wines in Cambridge, and here we are featuring two of our new wines from our July Wines of the Month. Okay, so first up we've got a fantastic new Vino Verde from Portugal. This is the Quinta da Raza Vino Verde 2014. Very much what we think of as a gin and tonic alternative. So really spritzy, fresh, very alive, citrus, stone fruits, very sort of classic style. There's a touch of spritz, so perfect for this time of year, especially in this hot weather, and made from local grape varieties, so mostly Arinto, Azal and Trajadura, which will no doubt trip off your tongue after you've had a bottle of this. Second up, we've got the new 2014 Bardolino from Reccia in Italy. We used to think of Bardolino as being one of the horrendous Italian reds. It's vastly improved. This is a classic sort of bright cherry, vibrant style. Definitely recommend putting this in the fridge for 10 to 15 minutes when it's 30 degrees outside. Probably think you should put all your reds inside the fridge for 10, 15 minutes. Warm red is pretty foul. Works great with the barbecues, really good with fish actually, especially on that on the barbecue. Otherwise, excellent with salads, but really juicy, very Moorish, and as we say, really great with a little bit of a chill to it. Okay, so just to summarise those two wines, the Quinta da Raza Vino Verde 2014, that's currently $9.25 a bottle. We're also doing that at a special case price of £100 for 12, which makes it just about £8.33. And the Reccia Bardolino, that's $7.50 a bottle. Otherwise, by the case, that's now $6.75, so a bit of a bargain for both of those. So these two wines are from Noel Young Wines. We're in Trumpington on the High Street. Phone number is 01223 566 744, or you can get both these wines on our website nywines.co.uk, and if you go through to the mixed cases and pick summer, you'll see these two wines featured amongst the 12.
Join me, Phil Rowe, for Sunday breakfast from 8 till 11 for some relaxing music, interviews with local people, newspaper and sports reviews, and the now legendary Cambridge Quiz. A great way to start your Sunday. Community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
We've talked about bees and edible flowers today, so it only seems fitting we attempt a little cross-pollination ourselves by promoting other programmes you can hear on Cambridge 105. Bookmark is a fortnightly show featuring Cambridge-based writers, and here, presenter Lee Chambers talks food with a famous author and columnist.
Bee Wilson is a food writer and historian. She writes a weekly food column for the Sunday Telegraph's Stella magazine and has been named Food Writer of the Year three times by the Guild of Food Writers. Her latest, Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat, examines the history and impact of changes in kitchen technology. That shows how food ties in with things like anthropology and sociology. You know, it really does pull everything together, doesn't it? It reflects us back to ourselves.
Yes, I mean, it was such fun to research. My problem is always kind of stopping the research and trying to pin it down and do the writing, because I didn't want it to be an encyclopedia. But yeah, it it does really relate to so many other subjects, whether it's kind of the history of technology or whether it's, as you say, anthropology and different attitudes people have had towards pottery and how we see them almost as members of the family, these objects that we surround ourselves with, or also the history of dentistry. I mean, the single thing that most startled me while I was writing my book was the fact that the structure of our jaws and teeth changed in response to the way that we use knives and forks. And that just, I thought, that can't be possible. And that definitely shows that the history of cutlery, never mind the history of food, is not trivial.
Because what you do in the book is you look at particular implements or particular pieces of technology and how they've changed over the years, so how they started maybe hundreds, sometimes thousands of years ago.
Exactly. I mean, I was trying to come at the subject from the point of view of, in a way, an ordinary home cook. I'm not writing as a spoon obsessive or an antiquarian.
That's a really...
yeah, I mean, there are lots of ways you might... Yeah. If you heard history of cooking technology, there are lots of things you might think, and you might think it's going to be some kind of antiques roadshow thing. And although I now find antique cutlery a very interesting subject, that wasn't my initial viewpoint. I'm trying to look at things that we might just take for granted, like a pestle and mortar or a peeler or a food processor, or even something I start the book with, something as basic as a wooden spoon, which you find in every kitchen, and talk about how actually it looks incredibly simple and basic, but there's engineering that goes into it. It's made out of a material that's very low in conductivity, so you don't burn your hand. And it's also an object that many of us feel incredibly fond of. And I think we sometimes neglect the fact that the utensils we use, they're not just about what works best or makes the most delicious meal. We want to reach for things which feel friendly and somehow make the whole process of cooking more enjoyable. And that's always been the case. If you kind of look back throughout history, people have lavished great artistry on kitchen objects in medieval times. To own something like a cauldron, that would be a really important possession. It was a kind of status.
And people have a sort of love for their pots. You talk about that, don't you? That emotional attachment to their...
Yeah. And why wouldn't you feel love when it's the thing that's enabling you to sort of eat well every evening? Mm. And pots are a really good example of something we totally take for granted, the fact that we can sort of go into our kitchen and boil something up. But it took ages in sort of long historical terms for people to think of boiling something in water rather than just shoving it in the fire, which would be roasting. And although pots go back at least 10,000 years, which sounds like a very long time, if you think that cooking things in the fire goes back maybe 2 million years... It's kind of relatively recent. And I think pots are also a really good example of the fact that once people arrived at the basic technology, not much changed. If you look at Roman cooking pots, they're not so different from our cooking pots. I mean, the pot is just a good thing to have around. Nobody's really thought of a kitchen without pots, or rather they did. In 1944 in America, they designed this kitchen of the future where pots would be replaced with these weird kind of plastic things that look a bit like washing machines, and you'd kind of lift the lid and just boil things. But no, we love pots.
And writing the book, did it mean that when you went back to these implements that you saw them in a different way? Because it does feel the book a bit of a journey for you. As you dig down into the pestle and mortar or the hearth or the fork, you find out the origins of it and where it went right and where it went wrong. So when you came back to look at your own pestle and mortar, which I know you've got a pestle and mortar in your kitchen that you love, did you see it through different eyes?
I did. I mean, sometimes it illuminated the reason why I had a particular attitude to something and I hadn't really thought about it before. So with the pestle and mortar, I love my pestle and mortar. It's made out of granite. I bought it copying Jamie Oliver because exactly the one that he had in one of his first series.
We've got that one.
And it's very heavy. And then I thought, yeah. I love this, but I don't get it down very often. Why is that? And then I suddenly thought, this is so strange. The pestle and mortar, which for cooks... never mind 10,000 years ago, even 100 years ago, would have been pretty crucial when you were having to grind even something like sugar before you used it. You'd have needed to use it very often. But in the age of the electric food processor, it's a completely superfluous but nevertheless lovely piece of equipment. So I thought, yeah, this is something which for me is just a leisure item. It's almost like aromatherapy, making pesto in a pestle and mortar, isn't it? You just get that lovely basil scent and the pine nuts, and it's such a satisfying process. But I only do it when I feel like it, whereas in the past, exact opposite, pestle and mortar was practically an instrument of torture.
And how did you choose which implements to focus on?
I thought of the big themes of the chapters, which are things like pots and pans, fire, ice quite early on. And then it was a case of trying to be ruthless about thinking, is this absolutely essential to explaining the story I want to tell in that chapter? And if not, it has to go. So there are loads of things. I mean, after I finished, I kept thinking, why didn't I put the pressure cooker in?
Could do a part two.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But I mean, it's meant to be also, if it starts a conversation and you think, well, you haven't included my favourite implement, at least you're reacting to the book.
That was an extract from a previous episode of Bookmark, talking with Bea Wilson about her book, Consider the Fork.
Onto the food and drink news now, and first off, you'll be getting a free glass of raspberry fizz if you book a table for dinner at Fitzbillies this month.
Street food van Providence Kitchen will be taking their wood-fired kitchen to Burwash Manor this weekend. And then they're off to Little Rose, Hazingfield, on Thursday the 16th of July. Hazingfield is the location of Hawthorne Farm from today's Bees and Honey feature. It's just on the outskirts of Cambridge, so worth a mention.
Bread and Meat on Bennett Street have a hot new special for the weekend, jerk chicken and coleslaw. Come and try it if you dare, said one of their recent tweets.
Elderflowers are in bloom, which means the chance to make the ancient British homemade elderflower cordial, sales of which are soaring. Moreover, why stop there? You can make your own elderflower and gooseberry ice cream, or even an elderflower cheesecake.
There's a free bottle of wine with every four diners at the Rainbow Cafe this weekend.
The monthly Jojo Coco Chocolate Workshop is taking place at Hot Numbers on Guider Street on Monday the 20th. It teaches you the tricks of the trade to make your own elegant boxes of chocolates. £15 per person, with 20 places available, you need to book. So just go to jojococo.co.uk.
And there's a Spanish summer pop-up dinner at Espresso Library on East Road on Thursday the 23rd, courtesy of Querico Tapas. Be there at 7:30 for an 8 p.m. dinner. £25 per person. For bookings, email querico@quericotapas.com.
And finally, there's a vegetarian pop-up at Ross Street Community Centre on Saturday, the 25th of July. It's a fundraiser for the Nepal Earthquake Appeal. It's three courses and also features a bar. £25 for adults, £10 for children. Booking is essential. Contact them at cadwins@hotmail.co.uk.
And cue the play-out music to signal the end of another edition of Flavour. We'll be repeated tomorrow at 7 a.m, and the podcast should be available by Tuesday, which you'll be able to find on the Cambridge 105 website, along with all of our previous editions.
You can also subscribe to Flavour on iTunes and find us on the Radio Player app. Remember too that you can keep in touch with Cambridge food and drink news by following Flavour on Twitter, @Flavour105.
Up next is Bookmark, whose guest this week is Big Issue founder John Bird, MBE, and former Fenland poet laureate Elaine Ewart on being inspired by the history and landscape of the Fens.
From 2 until 5 p.m, it's Summer Saturday, broadcasting live in and around Cambridge, taking in events, street parties, and this week, the big weekend on Parker's Peace.
At 5 p.m, it's Radio Dante, the programme for Italians in Cambridge. This episode, they're exploring Italian expressions that get lost in translation. The show is 30 minutes English, 30 minutes Italian. Then at 6, it's Jason Allen with more music from the 80s and 90s.
A huge thanks to all of our interviewees today, and thank you for listening. Our next episode is in 2 weeks' time on Saturday, the 25th of July. So for now, it's arrivederci from Flavour.
Arrivederci, ciao.
Ciao.
Goodbye.
Bye.